The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
You need to be so much more than just good at a sport. You learn more from your failures than you do from being successful.
I didn't think it would be a gold medal for Great Britain. It's got him on the scoreboard. It's confirmed. Another gold medal. What a night.
You know, for all the knocks that I've taken, this is the biggest comeback ever. This is the biggest confidence boost. You know, this is a new beginning. You know, my coach Linford Christie said, you know, this is the start. What have you done today?
Yes, indeed, the Olympics are upon us, and soon you will be awash with sporting information. Let's hope the same won't be true of the tracks, given the ferocity of our current rainstorms. Whether you're excited or exasperated by all the fuss, we come bearing a timely reminder that sport is in no way the enemy of literature. That's certainly the experience of Alexander MacLeod, a Canadian academic who got within a whisker of Olympic selection as a runner. His fine new collection of short stories opens with Miracle Mile, about the lives, rivalries and internal conflicts of two pro middle distance runners.
It's hard to tell anybody what it's really like. Most people have seen too many of those CBC profiles that run during the Olympics, the ones with the special theme music and the torch and all those fuzzy, soft camera shots that make everyone look so young and radiantly healthy. Everybody used to think they were going to make one of those little movies about me, but I know now it's never going to happen. It's timing. Everything is timing. I was down when I needed to be up. If we were both at our best, if Berner and I were both going at it at the top of our games, he would lose. We both knew this. My best times were ahead of his, but I was far from my best now. There were even high school kids coming up from behind and charging hard. I don't really know what I was waiting for in that room. I might cut the top five, maybe, but I knew I wouldn't be close enough to be in the photograph when the first guy crossed the line. It wasn't really competition anymore. For me, this was straight autopilot stuff, going through the motions and following my own ritual right through to the end. What about Bork, I said. This was the last part for Berner. I'd say the name of a guy who was going to be there with us, and he would describe the guy's weaknesses. Berner needed to do this, needed to know exactly why the others could not win. There were maybe 10 people like us in the whole country, and no more than 5 or 6 who had a real shot at making the team, but Berner needed to hate all of them. That was how he worked. I couldn't care less, but I did my part. I kept my eyes on the sprinklers, and I didn't even look at him. I just released the words into the air. I let Bork's name float away. Bork, what is Bork? A 339, 340 guy at the top end of his dreams. We won't even see him. Too slow. Period. We won't even see him. Dawson is supposed to be here, I said. He was the next guy on the list. He ran 337.5 at NC's last month. Got no guts, Berners sort of snorted it. Dawson needs everything to be perfect. He needs a rabbit and a perfectly even pace, and he needs there to be sunshine and no wind. He can run, no doubt, but he can't race. If you shake him up and throw any kind of hurt into him, he'll just fold. Guy's got tons of talent, but he's a coward. You know that, Mikey. Everybody knows that about Dawson. Even Dawson knows it deep down. If somebody puts in a 57-second four in the middle of it, Dawson will be out the back end and he'll cry when it's over. He will actually cry. You will see the tears running down his face. Marcotte will take it out hard right from the gun, I said. He'll open in 56 and then just try and hold on. He's crazy and he will never quit. There is no limit to how much that guy can hurt. But he can't hold it. You know how it'll be. Just like last week and the week before, it'll be exactly the same. Marcotte will blow his load too soon and we'll come sailing by with 300 to go. If we close in 42, we'll have nothing in the tank. He'll collapse and fall over at the finish line and somebody will have to carry him away. That's how we talked most of the time. The numbers meant more than the words, and the smaller numbers meant more than the bigger ones. It was like we belonged to our own little country and we had this secret language that almost nobody else understood. Almost nobody can tell you the real difference between 336 and 339. Almost nobody understands that there is something in there, something important and significant, just waiting to be released out of that space between the 6 and the 9. Put it this way, if you ever wanted to cross over that gap, if you ever wanted to see what it was like on the other side, you would need to change your entire life and get rid of almost everything else. You have to make choices. You can't run and be an astronaut. You can't run and have a full-time job. Can't run and have a girlfriend who does not run. When I stopped going to church or coming home for holidays, my mother used to worry that I was losing my balance. But I never met a balanced guy who ever got anything done. There's nothing new about this stuff. You have to sign the same deal if you want to be good, and I mean truly good, at anything. Berner and I and all those other guys, we understood this. We knew all about it. Every pure specialist is the same way, so either you know what I am talking about, or you do not.
Tell us a little bit more about it. The narrator there is Mikey, who is the more talented of two school friends who've become professional runners, more or less.
They are near Olympic caliber athletes, so they may make the team or they may not. So they hover there in the kind of third or fourth position in the kind of Canadian national scheme. So they are the kind of people who you might see in the semi-final of the Olympic 1500 here. So that means that they are better than 99.99999% of the world, but they aren't in that 0.0001 that they need to be in. So I was interested in the way that this summer the people who finished first, second, third in the 1500 will be important athletes in the world, and the people who finish 14th, 15th, and 16th will be forgotten, but they'll be significant to each other.
Now, there's a backstory to this, as there is with all of your stories, which is historical. Tell us about the backstory.
It makes reference to the famous Miracle Mile, which was the one moment in 1954 in the kind of precursor to the Commonwealth Games and the British Empire Games, held in Vancouver, where your own Roger Bannister and John Landy ran, where they were in the race for the first time when two men broke 4 minutes on the same track. And my two guys can both break four for the mile, and they aren't quite so significant.
And you point out the backward look that Landy gave, mm-hmm. and that backward look may have cost him the race.
It's a funny story because the statue is there in Vancouver. This is seen as a again, in my story, I'm interested in the way that the statue is wrong. The statue has famously Landy looking over his left shoulder while Roger Bannister passes him on the right. And of course, the person who was narrating the statue or taking that scene and saying, this is the meaning of this statue, that Landy was looking the wrong way and Bannister came by him in this shocking surprise. This is a story that kind of circulates around, but my guys have seen the video, and they know that Landy never thought he was going to hold off Bannister. And now there's video archival footage of interviews that were done post-race. When he was still there with 400 to go, I knew I was done. Landy says that now. So in the story, that's kind of one of the big climaxes for me in the story, is the guy saying, I know. So I look to the right, like I see it. I see it happening to me. And when it happens to me, we don't need to mythologize it.
In a way, it's a rite of passage story, isn't it? In that it's the moment at which he is going to leave history, the possibility of becoming part of history in his own head, isn't it?
That's a great insight. Yeah, I think that it's a person's relationship with their body, and him saying, "I have come as far as I can go at this, and when my friend passes me here," that's not just him passing me in this 60 meters to the end. It's the end of this. And somebody saying, like all the athletes here, we'll see it after the Olympics, there's always a big rash of retirements. Whatever happens in the London Olympics, some people's careers will be launched and they'll be getting ready for the next one. But a great many will say, I had this date circled as the day I stopped being what I have been being for 15, 16 years. I'll be something else after London. So I was interested in that.
Quite a melancholy thought for a debut collection.
I think of it as changing the central object of your care. Like at a certain moment, this is the thing that I cared about. And this did happen to me. I cared about running for a long time, and I still care about it. I ran.
You were a very good runner, were you?
I was okay. You know, I was
competitive runner.
Yes. I was a kind of an all-Canadian, whatever that means, in the international stage. But I had friends, like guys that I trained with, who were right at this level. My some of my best friends finished third in the Olympic trials, the Canadian Olympic trials, for several years in a row. Those are my roommates, people. Like it was definitely a subject that was going on in our house.
There is a sense of hard-won perception in this story. The blood on the trainers, for example. Mm-hmm. The trainers that don't fit because you have to wear them because the sponsor wants you to wear them.
Right, right. Like you get sent the shoes, so the shoes are free, but they might not be the shoes for your feet. And so you have to like break your feet in to fit the shoe more than the other way around. It's one of the ironies of achieving sponsorship, is then you have to wear the sponsored gear and it might not be the best gear for you.
And the other thing, of course, is that Mikey has damaged his Achilles tendon. Yeah, yeah. And he has to illegally treat himself.
There's a couple of kind of gruesome scenes in there about cortisone injections, where cortisone, I think, I'm not sure, maybe it's changed, but at the time, you were only supposed to, like your tissue could only absorb 3 shots of it.
And in a lifetime.
Yes, and then it would become too brittle that you'd actually, it wouldn't work as an anti-inflammatory, it would rupture the tendon. But these guys don't have any window, so like they have to be training, so they're going to take the 4th one or the 5th one and chance it. Lots of the stories involve some sort of risky behavior, but it's always a risk that's being taken because someone is kind of questing after something they think is significant. The rest of the world may think they're crazy, but I was very interested in the way that if you care about something, real care is kind of antisocial. So if you really care about your stamp collection and someone says, collecting stamps is stupid, that doesn't affect you. Like it doesn't, because you care about the object. So runners are that way.
And there are quite a few rite of passage stories in this, aren't there? I mean, one of the lovely ones is actually the title story, in which although it's not seen from the position of the kid who's going through the transition, it's a kid who has a summer job working on a building site, and it begins with very severe sunburn and ends with possibly fatal brawl. Mm-hmm. He's sort of being inducted into adulthood.
I was interested in the way that the worker guy who puts in the paving stone, he sort of passes through something because of the kid. And the kid actually wants to learn how to do it. And so for the narrator of the story, there's a moment there where he says, I have never taught anybody anything. Like no one has ever thought that I possessed some great skill. But now this guy's asking me, now how do you cut the pieces and how do you bring it around and how does this work? And so the idea that kind of work could be artistic or that he would possess a kind of artistry in what he does, that's the passage that he goes through. And then when the brawl comes, it's like, oh man, he feels a certain inevitability that he couldn't get away from this circumstance.
And is any of this from personal experience as well?
I did do that job. I did
in the summer.
Yes, I was a summer kid. I did a job like that, and then I went to a university which had beautiful pathways. And so I took a picture of them, and I sent them back to the guys, and I was like, think of how much work we get here on interlocking brick pathways. Like, there's this campus seems full of them. Like, and the idea being that students walking on cobblestone paths don't think about the people who put the cobblestones in. Paving stone is a kind of sculpture.
Light the flame, light the flame, light the flame. All the love that you get, give the same. Leave behind.
Alexander MacLeod's Light Lifting is published by Jonathan Cape. Let's broaden our sporting horizons now away from the athletics track, but to an arena just as crazily enthusiastic, where the Dallas Cowboys play their American football matches. Guests of honour for a gala match is a group of Iraqi vets from Bravo Squad, who have just become American heroes. It's the setting for Ben Fountain's first novel, Billy Lynn's Long Half-Time Walk.
Dallas, Dallas Cowboys, we are the Cowboys.
Billy is thinking if you took every person he's ever known in his life and added up the sum total of their wealth, this presumably grand number would still pale in comparison to the stupendous net worth of Norman Oglesby, or Norm, as he's known to the media, friends, colleagues, legions of Cowboys fans, and the even mightier legions of Cowboys haters who, for whatever reason, his smug kiss-my-ass arrogance say, or his flaunting of the whole America's team shtick, or his willingness to whore out the Cowboys brand to everything from toasters to tulip bulbs, despise the man's guts even as they're forced to admit his genius for turning serious bucks. Norm, the Normster, Norm. He figures prominently in the fantasy lives of fans everywhere, the antagonist in endless imagined arguments and the medium for all manner of secret wish fulfillment. For days, Sykes has been rehearsing his big moment with fuck Norm this and fuck Norm that. Gonna give my boy Norm buku shit for dealing Tresnoski. Like, hey, what the fuck, Norm? You trade your all-world linebacker for steroids on a stick? But when it's Sykes' turn to meet the Cowboys' owner, he rolls over and does a shameless bitch flop. It's an honor to meet you, sir, he says in hushed, reverent tones. I just want you to know, I've been a huge Cowboys fan my entire life. Well, it's my honor to meet you, Specialist Sykes, Norm rips back. I've been a huge fan of the United States Army for my entire life. The crowd gives up a big round of applause. They are in a large, bare room deep inside the stadium's bowels, a chilly space with concrete walls and cheap all-weather carpet that wicks the cold up through the floor in a palpable draft. Bravo has been brought here for an intimate meet and greet with the Cowboys brass and selected guests. Perhaps 200 people have gathered with many family units on display, as is surely right and fitting on this Thanksgiving Day. It's a class crowd, the men dressed in coats and ties, the women spiff in tailored suits with matching shoes and purses, though some of the hipper, edgier set make a winter fashion statement with skin-tight leathers and long fur coats. They could be the congregation of the richest church in town, our anorexic lady of the upscale honky bling. The only people of color here are the waitstaff and several gregarious former players, fan favorites from yesteryear who invested wisely and kept their noses clean. Billy and Mango appreciate that best behavior is called for at this top-shelf event, and thanks to Hector's primo herb, they are close to losing it. It is next to impossible not to bust up laughing, and if they do, no telling where it will end. An elderly priest with a lisp almost sets them off, then a lady whose hair resembles an exploded poodle. They are in that perilous state of stoned paranoia where surely everyone sees they've been toking up, which is terrifying and just the funniest thing ever. Be cool, they hiss at each other, giggling like a couple of deranged asthmatics. Think of something horrible, rectal bleeding, sucking chest wounds, tapeworms dangling from your nose. Okay, how do I look? Fucked up. They're whispering out the sides of their mouths. How about now? Still fucked up. Billy boots Mango with a behind-the-back crossover kick. Mango sends a quick jab to Billy's ribs, and they furtively cuff each other until Dime gives them a look. It has the feel of a high-speed spin-out, the wee-ha of Serious G's, plus awareness that it's probably going to turn out badly. But when Norm and company approach for the big introduction, it is time to square up and get straight for real.
Cowboys! Cowboys!
High formation, Dallas down six, Eagle ball, play action, going to throw to the right side, intercepted at the 45-yard line, down the sideline, to the 15, to the 10, it's a touchdown! It's Roy Williams! And the Cowboys are an extra point away from leading the game with two.
Danville's going to bounce off like a pinball and take this thing 80 yards for a touchdown, and the Cowboys are back in front.
We the Dallas Cowboys. We the Dallas
Cowboys. Ben, Billy is a 19-year-old war veteran. Can you be a war veteran at 19?
Absolutely. And at one point, he says to himself, well, maybe Iraq ages you in dog years. So even though he's 19, he's much older and wiser than his 19 years.
This is another great American sporting novel, but it's very different, isn't it? It's different in two senses. One, it's not really about the sport. It's about the culture of making heroes and how America looks at war. Two, it's very satirical.
The analogy between warfare and football, it's not an original idea. And it wasn't so much that I wanted to work that angle as try to capture a paradigm of America. Well, you know, what better place than Texas Stadium on Thanksgiving Day, a Dallas Cowboys football game, where you get this huge mashup of sport, popular culture, softcore porn, and American triumphalism all in this big stew. So, yeah, it's not so much examining football as the corporatization of football and American life in general, including war.
And this event, that it's a big set piece, which is a particular day of a particular match, indeed, which took place in 2004, really did happen with, rather surreally, Destiny's Child at the center of it.
I suppose it's surreal if you were an alien coming down to Earth and trying to figure out, you know, what the heck are these people doing here? But it's everyday life in America. You'll see this pretty much any Sunday in 15 or 20 different American cities. It's the surreal is the everyday when it comes to big entertainment, sports-related entertainment in the U.S.
So let's just go right back to the beginning and talk about the story. This is a story of a band of soldiers who have had a pretty horrible engagement in Iraq, in which one of their numbers have been killed.
Right.
And as they remark, they're being honoured for the worst day of their lives.
Right.
Where did that idea come from for you?
The background of it was this tremendous bewilderment and confusion I was feeling around 2003, 2004 about my country. And I was coming to the realization that I didn't understand America, this place where I was born and grew up and had spent my entire life. I had no idea why it is the way it is or why it does the things it does. And that feeling became especially acute after the 2004 elections. And as it happened 3 weeks later, we had a bunch of people over to our house for Thanksgiving, and the football game was on in the background on TV, and I actually started watching the halftime show. And, you know, Destiny's Child and lots of soldiers, and it was a military theme, yet presented for popular consumption without the slightest gesture toward what combat is really about or what war is about. And I thought, this is the most insane thing I've ever seen. And so that was the impulse for the book.
And it's very much about the way that television recreates in what it wants to see, isn't it? So they were the squad in the novel weren't actually originally called Bravo Squad, were they? They have been dubbed Bravo Squad because it's a name fit for heroes.
Right. It's there's Bravo in their military hierarchical name at some point, but you don't have Bravo Squad, Alpha Squad. You have Squads 1 and 2. It gets shorthanded to Bravo Squad along the way.
Now, you have had two particular citations, very different people. One is Carl Melantes, who is a Vietnam vet, who wrote a novel about Vietnam, who described it as the catch-22 of the Iraq War. I couldn't quite understand where he was coming from with that, but it's a very nice citation. Mm-hmm. And the other, really completely contrastingly, is from Diana Athill, who's the sort of grande dame of British editing, who described it as a blazingly good novel and vital, important book about war and the world we live in.
I think what Carl was thinking, I mean, he was focusing on the general, you know, the exploration of the absurdity of war. And that registered for him in terms of Catch-22. I have to say, I wasn't thinking about Catch-22 a whole lot when I was writing the book. I was thinking more about Robert Altman, actually the filmmaker, and especially movies like Nashville, where you have this, you know, ensemble of characters. And everybody's got their own agenda and, you know, their own racket they're working. And so you have all these, you know, shifting, overlapping encounters, you know, of various people. And they're all talking, and they're talking to each other, but really they're talking past each other.
And also the language is very picturesque. You chose a bit that was quite tame compared to some of the language in it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they are soldiers. And that's the general idiom of soldiers, you know, obscenity. And I think there's a reason for that. They're dealing with situations that are so extreme and freighted that at a certain point, obscenity becomes an expression of basic human decency. It had to sound a certain way. The language had to do something apart from, you know, just conveying, you know, the substance. The language had to do some work all its own and convey this sense of, you know, recklessness or just sensory overload, or I just wanted to pack the language as densely as I could.
Now, you come with your own story, don't you, which is it's rather wonderful for somebody of my age, which is that you've taken a good many years to write this. It's your first novel.
Right. I started writing when I was 30. I had been practicing law before then. And I assumed that, you know, I would have more or less a standard trajectory. You know, there would be 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years of paying your dues. And at a certain point, you would break through and you would have something that started to resemble a career. And it took me 17 years to get my book contract. I spent quite a few years, both before and after the short story collection, working on a novel called The Texas Itch, which takes place in Dallas. And at a certain point, it crashed and burned. And so I started writing Billy Lynn in 2009. So it took me about 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm. How did you keep going so long? That's a very, very long time to keep faith in yourself as a writer.
I guess it is. You know, for the first 5 or 6 or 7 years, I'd say fantasy and delusion kept me going. You know, this the writer's fantasy of, okay, you write for a while, you produce a certain amount of work, and sooner or later, you know, agents and publishers will beat a path to your door. And after about 10 years, when that hadn't happened, I had to sit down and really think about why I was doing this. And, I mean, nobody wants to waste their life. I finally decided, well, I enjoy the work. And, in fact, I can't conceive of doing any other kind of work at this point. And I'm also at home raising my kids and running the house. And so I decided, even if I never have any worldly success, I'm going to keep on doing this. I just got kind of zen about it. At a certain point, I just thought, well, it feels right. It feels like a worthy thing to do. I'm just going to keep doing it.
How did you live? How did you pay your way?
Oh, I sponge off my wife. I'm married to a very smart woman who has a successful law career, and she was willing to put up with this decades-long project of me trying to figure out how to write a book.
You can be so swift, you
make a name further.
Ben Fountain there. Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk is published by Canongate. That's just a flavour of some of the sporting themes that have miraculously emerged in fiction in time for the Olympics 2012. Yay! Joining me to review some of the non-fiction offerings is our writer Andy Bull.
I'm deluged with books from sports publishing companies, and some of them take my fancy. They end up coming home to go on the shelf along with the others, to my wife's despair.
Let's start with The Secret Olympian, which is a book close to our heart. We have the secret footballer, don't we?
We do. I wonder if they stole the idea from us.
I think they did.
Actually.
Yeah. I think we ought to start laying our claim now, since this is quite likely to be quite successful, this book, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of the bigger books of the summer, Olympics-wise. It's an interesting one, it really is. It's anonymous, obviously. We gather he was probably a rower or a cycler, and he competed at the 2004 Olympics. And he's really giving us the inside track on what it's like to be an athlete at an Olympic Games. And I found it very enjoyable, actually. Yeah.
Why? How do you know he was a rower or a cyclist? And why such two very different sports?
Well, it's almost like doing a crossword, you know. There are little clues here and there throughout the book. And if you kind of can read between the lines, then you'll piece together an idea of who this chap is from things he says, little details about his event, but he never actually tells you definitely what he does.
Is this just a publishing tease? Because he doesn't actually spill any great beans, does he? He's not into doping or anything like that.
No, and actually that's one of the more disappointing aspects of it. He has very little to say about doping, really, and just says, I never came across it, never happened to me. So if you're hoping for kind of juicy insight there, you won't get any. It is a bit of a tease, it's a bit of a gimmick, and the man can write, which is the main thing. When you have a sportsman writing, you're always worried about how good he is, actually is at the craft of it, and he's done a very good job.
One of the interesting things he does is talks about some of the myths about these great athletes, one of which is that they weren't all brilliant athletes at school, which maybe actually make a lot of kids around the country very happy.
Yeah, that's right. They're often quite, and particularly in Olympic sports, like if you were talking about a rower, for example, you can have very tall, gangly people who are really very quite uncoordinated at ball sports, for example. So it's really finding their niche. And that's what he says he did. He found his niche as an athlete. And he was really very good at that one thing and quite hopeless at everything else.
He says he was hopeless at football and rugby.
There you go. Exactly.
No, yeah. He wasn't into that. And he also talks about Nick Bell taking up fencing because he couldn't do rugby. I mean, how fascinating is that?
Yeah, that's often the way with these little niche sports that people, you know, they start young, develop a real enthusiasm for them. And yeah, you'll see a lot of those people in the Olympics. It's that really their one chance they get every 4 years to shine in front of a large audience, having lived in obscurity for the last 3 years and 50 weeks.
And then being destined to go back to it for a lot of them.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And that's really, actually, on a slight tangent, one of the reasons why I enjoy the Olympics so much, because you're writing about normal people doing extraordinary things. The Secret Olympian is also, he goes in for that bit of an old cliche now, actually, but talking about the kind of party atmosphere in the athletes' village, and that's where he's very good. You know, and you have those stories that are trotted out at every Olympic Games about the number of condoms that the athletes get through and things like this. And that's really where I think this book works well, because it's impossible for the press to get into the athlete's village, and it's impossible for the public to know what the atmosphere is like inside it. So that's what he's very good at, letting you know what athletes are really like behind closed doors.
The Secret Olympian is published by Bloomsbury. Now, you mentioned that had no juicy insights on doping. A book that does have juicy insights, but of a rather scientific bent, is Run, Swim, Throw, Cheat, The Science Behind Drugs in Sport by Chris Cooper, as it would with that title.
I thought this was going to be a fascinating book, and it is in a way, although it's very dry and scientific. He's a biochemist at the University of Essex, and really one of the leading experts in his field. And he goes through in meticulous detail how athletes dope, why athletes dope, what the different types of drugs do to improve performance, and he looks at the future of doping. It's not really one for the casual reader, but if you're interested in that area, then it's a must read, really.
It's got fascinating historical anecdotes in it, hasn't it? For example, I didn't know that the 1938 European champion high jumper Dora Ratjen was male. Put in. I mean, that was sort of a scandal of the Nazi era Germany, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, there were a few of those kinds of stories, and he touches on that because of an athlete who was very controversial at the last Olympics called Caster Semenya, who's a South African runner who has an intersex condition. So he's talking about the history of that and how the IOC had to introduce gender testing of the most basic kind basically involves pulling down your trousers. Because of a series of athletes, yeah, who
were actually pretending to be the other
yes,
sex.
Yeah, there was more than one example of that.
But they've got, of course, much more sophisticated now, haven't they? And there's one statistic that he gives, which is that at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, 8 of 3,387 female athletes were found to possess a Y chromosome, a lot more than in the average population.
Yeah, absolutely. And Caster Semenya is not the only one. There's also been a runner from Sri Lanka who's had exactly the same experience.
But it also raises other issues about inequalities, unfairnesses, genetic unfairnesses. And another of the cases he quotes is the Finnish cross-country skier who got golds in 1916, 1964 in the Winter Olympics, who had abnormally high levels of hemoglobin in his red blood cells, and all his family were found to have it. And that meant that he could carry more oxygen.
And one of the conclusions he reaches is that the future of doping is what he calls genetic doping and tampering with genes. And he thinks really that's a field that's just starting to emerge now. But really, you're right. He's doesn't take a black and white stance on any of this. He's very much someone who looks at all the shades of grey and everything, which makes it, again, a very interesting book. And that example you were just mentioning is fascinating and not one I'd heard before.
So if you're interested in the scientific side of sport, Run, Swim, Throw, Cheat is published by Oxford University Press. Now, on to a more sort of comic side of this whole sporting brouhaha is a book about the 1908 Olympics. London's Olympic Follies, The Madness and Mayhem of the 1908 Games, and it's by Graham Kent. What is this like and what sort of spills does this tell us about?
Yeah, I can see the publisher's eyes lighting up when this one was pitched, because it's a tale of what a terrible mess Britain made of hosting the 1908 Games. And really, our national pastime is moaning, and there's a lot of moaning being done about these Olympics this summer. It's kind of reassuring to know we were doing that 104 years ago as well. It's a nice little book with good anecdotes, well told, a few factual errors that will annoy the pedants. And it really concentrates on how outraged the American team were at the way they were treated in Britain and the controversy that came about because of that. So the American team, for example, in 1908, refused to lower their flag to the king at the procession, which caused an enormous controversy at the time. And there are other anecdotes of that kind. A lot of good historical research has gone into it. It's a nice book.
Are there a lot of books like this around, or are these four of a pack?
Yeah, I'm surprised there weren't more. I wonder if publishers find Olympic books quite difficult to categorise simply because they don't know quite where it sits on a shelf. It doesn't appeal to one specific sports market, which is what a lot of sports books tend to be, a cricket book, a rugby book, a football book. These ones are more generic, so they're harder to place. And we've not had any really big books of the Olympic summer. The Secret Olympian is probably the closest we've had to that. What we have had are a lot of smaller, interesting books for kind of not minority audiences, but more niche audiences, like some of the ones we've been talking about. I think after the Games, when we've had a few stars created, that's probably when we'll get the bigger Olympic books in time for Christmas. And we'll
there'll have all those awful biographies,
yes,
won't it? Of,
yes,
somebody who ran one race in,
yes,
20 seconds. And
exactly.
They build a book around it.
Ghostwritten books, biographies of people who spent 20 years swimming up and down a 50-metre swimming pool, that kind of thing. So the big books will probably come later in the year.
OK, if I were to ask you to put your money on who is going to emerge in the Christmas celebrity sports books market, who would you say?
That's a very good question. I think there are a lot of very talented, young, photogenic female swimmers who are going to win medals at this Games for Great Britain. I expect one or two of them will make a big breakthrough. There's a girl called Kerri-Ann Payne who is very likely to win a gold medal. I'm sure she could be a star if she wanted to be. Tom Daly, I think, has already had a book out, The Diver, which is very silly given that he's only 17 years old, but I'm sure
there's been at least another 3 months since that one was published.
Exactly. I'm sure we'll be hearing more of him. And Jessica Ennis as well, who's our star poster girl of the Games. I'm not sure if she has done a book or not, but if she hasn't, I'm sure she will do before the end of the year.
Now, we haven't talked about cycling, and of course it's the cyclists who've been doing it for me.
Oh, yeah.
Are we going to have the Bradley Wiggins book? Are we going to have the Chris Hoy book? I know we've had them already. Are we going to have more of those as well?
Yeah, Bradley Wiggins, who's doing very well in the Tour de France at the moment, he looks certain to be an absolute star of the summer, so we might well see one from him. One of the former cyclists actually is Richard Moore, who was a professional cyclist in the 1990s, and he's written what's supposed to be a very good book called The Dirtiest Race about the 1988 Olympic 100 metres, which was when Ben Johnson was disqualified for doping. Richard's another example, a rare example, of a former athlete who's become a very, very good writer. And that, again, is a book I haven't read yet, but I want to, and I'm told it's very, very good.
So if anybody is packing their case and going off for the summer outside the Olympic Village and you want to take something with you to remind you of what's going on, The Dirtiest Race in History, Ben Johnson, Carl Lewis and the Olympic 100-metre final is published by Wisden Sports Writing, and it's by Richard Moore. Andy, thank you very much for coming in, and now we'll let you go back to your ringside seat. Pass the flame, pass the flame. And that's all from us this week. If you want more literary distractions over the coming weeks, do read The Guardian Saturday Review, which will be showcasing the 20 must-read novels of the year and taking a sneak preview of the autumn. Thanks to Ben Fountain, Alexander McLeod, Andy Ball. All together now from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Tim Mabey. On your marks, get set, go!
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.